About quite a few years ago in the 1960s, I agreed in a weak moment to give a talk with the title Language and Freedom. And when the time came to think about it, I realized I might have something to say about language and about freedom, but the word "and" was posing a serious problem. There is a possible strand that connects language and freedom, actually has an interesting history of exploring it, primarily in the 18th century. But in substance, it's pretty thin and speculative. And not surprisingly, I have the same problem today. There are useful things, I think, to say about universality in language and also about universality of human rights. But that troublesome connective is still raising difficulties. The only way I can think of dealing with the dilemma is to say a few things about each of the two topics with barely a hint about the conjunction, leaving that problem for you to deal with unless Liz solves it in her remarks. Well, let me begin with universality in language. The most productive way to approach the problem, as far as I know, is within the framework of what's come to be called the biolinguistic perspective in the last 40 or 50 years. It's an approach to language that began to take shape in the early 1950s. It was very much influenced then by recent developments in mathematics and biology. And the approach interacted productively with a more general shift of perspective in the general study of mental faculties, sometimes called the cognitive revolution. It would be more accurate, I think, to call it a second cognitive revolution, which revived and extended important insights and contributions of the cognitive revolution of the 17th and 18th century, which really deserves the name, I think. It was regrettably had been forgotten by the 1950s, in fact, long before, and is still largely unknown. In the 1950s, the study of language and mind was commonly considered part of what were called the behavioral sciences, all aspects of sociology, psychology, and so on. Well, as the name indicates, the object of inquiry in the behavioral sciences was taken to be behavior. And for linguistics, that meant also the products of behavior, like texts or a corpus elicited from a native informant. Linguistic theory consisted of procedures of analysis, primarily segmentation and classification, it's both European and American, guided by limited assumptions about structural properties and their arrangements. One prominent theoretician in 1955, Martin Jos, hardly exaggerated in an exposition of the fields when he identified the decisive direction as the decision that language can be described without any pre-existent scheme of what a language must be. And prevailing approaches in the behavioral sciences generally were rather similar. It was very common to suppose that apart from some initial delimitation of elementary properties that could be easily detected in the environment, what Quine, in his highly influential framework, called a quality space. Apart from that, undifferentiated learning mechanisms of some kind would account for what organisms know and do that would include humans. The biolinguistic approach, along with related areas of the cognitive sciences, adopted a quite different stance. It took the object of inquiry to be not behavior or its products, but rather the internal systems that enter into behavior, into action and interpretation, and at a deeper level, the basis in our biological nature for the growth and development of these internal systems. The goal was to discover what a 16th century innovator, Juan Huarte, described as the essential property of human intelligence, the capacity of, I'm quoting him, the capacity of the human mind to engender within itself by its own power the principles on which knowledge rests. These are ideas which were developed in quite important ways in the years that followed, up to the early 19th century. For language, the principles on which knowledge rests are those of the attained state of some internal faculty, the language faculty. The knowledge that rests on those principles covers a very wide range, from sound to structure to meaning. In even the most elementary cases one can think of, turns out that what is known is quite intricate when you look closely, even the simplest words, for example. So I'll just take one that interested British empiricists. Just consider the Charles River over there, or wherever it is. Thomas Hobbes was interested in the idea of what a river is, and he suggested that rivers are mentally individuated by their place of origin. So it would be the same river if it went somewhere else but originated in the same place. The concept river is what he and others at the time called a common notion that is part of innate knowledge, and this would be one of its inherent properties. Well, that's part of the picture, but it's not quite accurate, and it only scratches the surface of the common notion, as we can quickly discover just by thinking about it a little. We all know that it would remain the very same river under quite extreme changes, but it wouldn't be a river at all under extremely slight changes. So it would still be the Charles River, contrary to Hobbes, if the course reversed, it went the other direction, or if it was divided into separate streams that converge in some new place, or if whatever H2O happens to be in it, assuming there is any, is replaced with chemicals from some upstream faculty, manufacturing plant. And many other changes, still be the Charles River. On the other hand, it wouldn't be a river at all if it was directed within fixed boundaries and was used for shipping freight, let's say. Then it would be a canal, not a river. Or if the surface were hardened by some virtually undetectable physical change, a line was painted down the middle, and it was used to commute downtown to Boston. Highway. As we proceed, we find much more intricate properties. That's true no matter how simple the words we investigate. Commonplace facts like these completely undermine a conventional, almost universal approach to reference that's based on some word-object relation which is completely mystical. Insights about these matters were explored from Aristotle up through the British empiricists, but they've been mostly lost today. I think the proper conclusion is that even the most elementary human concepts appear to be entirely different from anything found, so far at least, in animal symbolic or communicative behavior, which is a significant problem for evolutionary biology, one of several in this connection. And the problems mount very rapidly when we move from simple words to expressions formed from them. I won't spend time on examples. What is known turns out to be extremely intricate and subtle and almost divorced from any evidence we have. Well, that poses one essential task of inquiry, namely to determine the principles on which such knowledge rests for the widest variety of possible human languages. And behind it is a deeper problem to discover what Huarte called the power to engender these principles of internal language. In current terms, that would mean the virtually uniform biological endowment that constitutes this particular cognitive faculty, the human language faculty. The power to engender an internal language, that's the topic of what's commonly now called universal grammar, that's adapting a traditional term to a new context. And it's in this context that a coherent and useful notion of universality in language arises. These would be universals of language, would be the universal properties of the biological endowment. essentially the genetic component of the language faculty. One significant insight of the first cognitive revolution was that properties of the world that are informally called mental may involve unbounded capacities of a finite organ. It's the finite use of infinite means in Wilhelm von Humboldt's phrase. And in a rather similar vein, Hume, before him, had recognized that our moral judgments are unbounded in scope and must be founded on general principles, finite general principles, that are part of our nature, although beyond what he called our original instincts. And that observation poses Huarte's problem in a different domain, and in fact is one of the thin threads that link to the topic that were announced today. By the mid-20th century, when all of this had been completely forgotten, it had become possible to reinvent and face those problems in a more substantive way than before. By that time, there was a clear understanding of finite generative systems with unbounded scope, and that could readily be adapted to reframing and investigating some of the traditional questions that had been necessarily left quite obscure before that understanding developed, although it's important to stress only some of the traditional questions. Von Humboldt, in the phrase I quoted and elsewhere, was talking about infinite use, which is quite a different matter from unbounded scope, and the same is true of the Cartesian science from which this flowed. Another influential factor in the renewal of the cognitive revolution was the work of ethologists, at that time, early 50s, just coming to be easily accessible, with its concern for what was called the innate working hypotheses present in subhuman organisms and the human a priori, which should have much the same character. That's Tinbergen and Lawrence. That framework, too, could be adapted to the study of human cognitive organs and their genetically determined nature, and those few of us who were interested in these topics were reading them avidly at the time. Meanwhile, kind of in parallel, efforts, pretty intensive efforts, to sharpen and refine the procedural approaches of structural linguistics ran into serious difficulties, revealing what appeared to be intrinsic inadequacies. As you pursued it further, it became increasingly clear that even the simplest elements don't have a kind of a beads on a string character that's required for procedures of segmentation and classification to work. Rather, they relate much more indirectly to sound, to phonetic form. They do have properties and a nature, but their nature and properties are fixed by the role they play within an internal computational system that determines an unbounded range of expressions. And closer study of the postulated mechanisms of learning in the behavioral sciences generally also revealed fundamental inadequacies, and pretty soon questions were arising right within the core disciplines as to whether their concepts, even their major concepts, could be sustained. Well, a natural conclusion from all of this seemed to be that the internal language that's attained has roughly the character of a scientific theory, an idealized scientific theory, that is an integrated system of rules and principles from which the expressions of the language can be derived. And the child must somehow select the internal language from the flux of experience. The problem is similar to what Charles Sanders Peirce, founder of pragmatism, had called abduction in his consideration of scientific discovery. And just as in the case of the sciences, the task is impossible without initial limitations on admissible hypotheses, as Peirce put it, initial limitations that permit only certain theories even to be entertained, but not infinitely many others that would be compatible with any relevant data. In the language case, it appeared that universal grammar must impose a format for rule systems that's highly articulated and specific to language and is sufficiently restrictive so that the candidate languages are kind of scattered, so that only a small number of them can even be considered in the course of language acquisition. Otherwise, it would be impossible. To quote from work of the 1960s, the most challenging theoretical problem in linguistics is that of discovering the principles of universal grammar, which determine the choice of hypotheses, the initial conditions that say, here's the class you can even think of, the accessible internal languages. That's the major problem. At the same time, it was recognized that for language, as for other biological systems, there is a still more challenging problem, at least at the horizons, and that is, still quoting from the 60s, to discover the laws that determine possible successful mutation and the nature of complex organisms. Investigation of factors like those seemed too remote to merit much attention, but they were kind of in the background, even in some of the earliest work. For example, on for those of you who are familiar with the field, the work on elimination of redundancy in rule systems back in the 50s, which was kind of implicitly guided by such concerns. And they do bear directly on universality in language, namely insofar as these factors, general organism-independent factors, enter into growth and development, less is attributed to universal grammar, to the genetically determined initial state. Well, by the early 1980s, a substantial shift in perspective within linguistics had reframed the questions quite considerably. It led to an abandonment, total abandonment of the format conception of linguistic theory in favor of an approach that sought to limit attainable languages literally to a finite set, apart from lexical choices. As a research program, that shift was highly successful. It led to an explosion of empirical inquiry into a wide range of typologically varied languages. A lot of new theoretical questions were posed that could scarcely have been formulated before. Sometimes they got at least partial answers. At the same time, this revitalized related areas of language acquisition and processing. Another consequence relevant here is that the shift removed some fundamental conceptual barriers to the serious inquiry into deeper principles in growth and development of language and beyond universal grammar. According to this conception that took over, acquisition of language is dissociated from the fixed principles of universal grammar, and it doesn't compel the conclusion that the format provided by universal grammar has to be highly articulated and specific to the language faculty so as to restrict the space of admissible hypotheses. Acquisition would simply be a matter of making some choices within a finite set, like answering a finite number of questions in a questionnaire, but the principles of language would be fixed independently of that and would always operate. Well, it had been recognized since the origins of modern biology, since Darwin's day, that general structural and developmental constraints enter into the growth of organisms and their evolution. It was discussed by Thomas Huxley, for example. By now, such considerations have been adduced for a wide range of problems of development and evolution, ranging from cell division to optimization of structure and function of cortical networks and complex organisms, even humans. Well, assuming that language has the general properties of other biological systems, we should therefore be seeking three factors that enter into the growth of language in the individual. One of them is genetic factors, the topic of universal grammar. These factors for the infant interpret part of the environment reflexively as linguistic experience, which is non-trivial, and then determine the general course of the development of the languages attained. Second factor is experience, which permits variation within a restricted range. Third factor is principles that are not specific to the faculty of language, probably to the organism. This third factor for language, one would expect to include principles of efficient computation for computational systems. That's what you'd look for, determining the general character of attainable languages and probably much broader in scope. Well, at this point, you have to go on to more technical discussion than is possible here, and I won't try, but I think it's fair to say that there's been considerable progress in sharpening and moving towards principled explanation in terms of these third factor considerations. Now, that considerably sharpens the question of the specific properties that determine the nature of language with each step toward principled explanation in this sense. You gain a clearer grasp of the universals of language, but it's important to keep in mind that any such progress leaves completely unresolved the fundamental problems that have been raised for hundreds of years. Among these are the still quite mysterious problem of the ordinary creative and coherent use of language, which was a core problem for Cartesian science and the first cognitive revolution generally. Well, at this point, we're moving into domains of will and choice and judgment and the thin strands that may connect what seems within the range of scientific inquiry and essential problems of human life. In particular, the vexed questions about universal human rights. One possible way to connect the dots would be by proceeding along the lines of David Hume's remarks, which I mentioned earlier, his observation, again, that the unbounded range of moral judgments must be founded on finite general principles that are part of our nature, though they lie beyond our original instincts, which he took to include what he called the species of natural instincts on which all human knowledge and belief are grounded. In recent years, there's been intriguing work in moral philosophy and experimental cognitive science that carries these ideas forward, discovering and investigating what seem to be deep-seated moral intuitions that often have quite a surprising character using simple invented cases. Liz has a lot more to say about this work than I do, so I'll drop it. But just to illustrate, I'll take a real example that, in fact, carries us right directly to universality of human rights. So this is a real one. In 1991, the chief economist of the World Bank wrote an internal memo on pollution, not intended for distribution. In the memo, he demonstrated that the World Bank should be, this is mostly quotes, the bank should be encouraging migration of polluting industries to the poorest countries. The reason is that measurement of the costs of health-impairing pollution depends on the foregone earnings from increased morbidity and mortality. So it's rational for health-impairing pollution to be sent to the poorest countries where mortality is higher and wages are lowest. And as he pointed out, other factors lead to the same conclusion. For example, the fact that what he called aesthetic pollution concerns are more welfare enhancing among the rich, like people like us care about them more than poor people. And as he pointed out, quite correctly, the logic is impeccable, and any moral reasons or social concerns that might be adduced could be turned around and used more or less effectively against every bank proposal for liberalization, so they can be dismissed as irrelevant. This is all quotes. The memo was leaked, and it elicited a storm of protest. Rather typical was Brazil's Secretary of the Environment, who wrote chief economist a letter saying that your reasoning is perfectly logical but totally insane. He was fired. The author of the memo went on to become Treasury Secretary under Clinton and later the president of the place down the street. What's relevant here is the virtual unanimity of the moral judgment that the reasoning is logical but insane. it's hard to find anyone who is willing to affirm the conclusion that does follow by impeccable logic. And that merits a closer look. It's one of these cases of very strong moral intuitions. And when we look at it, we get straight into the heart of the modern history of human rights doctrines. There is a standard codification of human rights in the modern period. That's the Universal Declaration, which was adopted in December 1948 by almost all nations, at least in principle. Contrary to what's often said, the Universal Declaration reflected a very broad cross-cultural consensus, participation from all over the place. And all of its components were taken to have equal status. That is, from what are sometimes called anti-torture rights to socioeconomic rights, such as the ones that are enumerated in Article 25, which I'll quote, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care and necessary social services, and the right to security in the event of unemployment, sickness, disability, widowhood, old age, or other lack of livelihood in circumstances beyond his control. These provisions have been reaffirmed in the enabling conventions of the General Assembly, which are intended to implement the stated rights, and also in international agreements on the right of development, usually in virtually the same words. Well, it seems reasonably clear that this formulation of universal human rights rejects the impeccable logic of the chief economist of the World Bank, if not as insane, at least as profoundly immoral, which was, in fact, the virtually universal judgment, at least insofar as it was publicly expressed. People thought, I don't know. Here, the word virtually must not be overlooked. It was a virtually universal judgment. As is well known, many nations are condemned as what are called relativists, who interpret the Universal Declaration selectively and reject components that they don't like. There's been a great deal of indignant rhetoric about what are called Asian relativists, or, of course, the unspeakable communists who descend to this degraded practice. For some reason less noticed is that the leader of the relativist camp happens to be the leader of the self-designated enlightened states, the world's most powerful state. We see examples of this almost daily, although see is perhaps the wrong word, because we see them but manage not to notice them. So to illustrate, let's just go back 2 weeks ago to March 1st. On March 1st, there were lead stories in the press on the release of the State Department's annual report on human rights around the world. The spokesperson at the news conference unveiling the report was Paula Dobrianski, who's the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs. And she emphasized, I'm quoting her, that promoting human rights is not just an element of our foreign policy, it is the bedrock of our policy and our foremost concern. That's as much as it was reported, but there's a little more to the story, as often the case. Dobrianski was Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Human Affairs in the Reagan and Bush number one administrations, and in that capacity, she sought to dispel certain myths about human rights. The most salient is the myth that so-called economic and social rights constitute human rights. And she denounced the efforts to obfuscate human rights discourse by introducing these spurious rights, which are entrenched in the Universal Declaration, which in turn was formulated at U.S. initiative, but is explicitly rejected by the U.S. government. Let me stress U.S. government. The population has sharply different opinions and attitudes, as we would expect when we look at universals of human rights and moral universals generally. And again, there's a very clear current illustration, which isn't being reported. Part of it was the federal budget was announced a couple of weeks ago, next year's federal budget, and along with it, there was released something that wasn't reported, namely a study of public reactions to the budget by the world's most prestigious institution for the study of public opinion, the Program on Policy Attitudes at the University of Maryland. The public, turns out, calls for drastic cuts in military spending, sharply increased social spending for education, medical research, job training, conservation and renewable energy, increased spending for the United Nations and economic and humanitarian aid, and reversal of Bush's tax cuts for the wealthy. Government policy is dramatically the opposite in every respect, and there's very little discussion about that within the political system or the intellectual culture, the media, etc. There's a lot of concern these days, international concern here too, about the consequences of what are called the twin deficits that are expanding, the trade and budget deficits. Closely related to them is a third deficit, the growing democratic deficit. It's the term we use for others who have formal democratic institutions, but they don't function. And that's very little discussed, because the democratic deficit is very much welcomed by wealth and power, which have every reason to want the public removed from policy choices and implementation, which should be a matter of considerable concern, quite apart from its relation to universal human rights. Well, in extenuation of Dobryansky, I should say that it's unfair to focus on her because her position is standard. UN Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick described the socioeconomic provisions of the Universal Declaration as a letter to Santa Claus. Neither nature, experience, nor probability informs these lists of entitlements, that's in quote, scare quotes, entitlements which are subject to no constraints except those of the mind and appetite of their authors. And the same view was expressed in 1990 by the U.S. representative to the U.N. Commission on Human Rights, Ambassador Morris Abram. He was explaining Washington's unilateral veto of the U.N. resolution on the right of development, which virtually repeated the socioeconomic provisions of the Universal Declaration. But these are not rights, Abram informed the commission. They yield conclusions that seem preposterous. They are little more than an empty vessel into which vague hopes and inchoate expectations can be poured, and they're even a dangerous incitement. The fundamental error of the alleged right to development is that it presupposes Article 25 of the Universal Declaration and assumes that it actually means what it says, and is not a mere letter to Santa Claus, and that's preposterous, clearly. So it would seem to follow, then, that we should affirm the impeccable logic of the Summers memo on pollution, though no one says so in public, perhaps because they would be regarded as insane. Well, this teaches us something about several topics. One of them is about universal moral judgments, and the other is about the moral and intellectual culture in which we live, which forcefully rejects universal moral judgments. There are innumerable other cases. I presume you noticed a couple of days ago at the appointment of John Bolton as ambassador to the UN that Condoleezza Rice praised Jean Kirkpatrick as a model for what an ambassador should be, you know, reiterating what I just said implicitly. Bolton himself has been clear and forthright in expressing his attitudes toward the UN. He said, "There is no United Nations. When the United States leads, the United Nations will follow. When it suits our interests to do so, we will do so. When it does not suit our interests, we will not do so." That position happens to be maybe a little bit extreme, but it's right about at the main bipartisan and educated consensus. But it happens to be opposed by an overwhelming majority of the public. In fact, public support for the UN is so strong that a majority of the public even think that the U.S. should give up the Security Council veto and accept majority decisions, which is an unspeakable notion in the intellectual culture. And the numbers are kind of interesting in all these cases because the people who express these views have never heard them. Each one must think I'm crazy, but that's what I think. If they were ever discussed, there'd be a, you can guess that the numbers, which are high, would be even higher. But again, the democratic deficit prevails, so we don't have to worry about universal moral judgments. The principle of universality arises in other important connections, too. One instructive example has occupied the World Court for several years. After the 1999 NATO bombing of Serbia, a group of international lawyers presented the International Tribunal on Yugoslavia with charges against NATO. They were relying on documentation which was produced by the major human rights organizations and, in fact, admissions by the NATO command. The prosecutors refused to consider the matter in violation of tribunal rules, simply stating that they relied on NATO's good faith. They undoubtedly knew what would happen to them if they didn't. Yugoslavia, however, proceeded. It took the matter to the World Court, and the U.S. alone withdrew from the proceedings at the World Court. The reason was that Yugoslavia had invoked the Genocide Convention, which the U.S. had, in fact, signed after 40 years, but with a reservation that it does not apply to the United States, which therefore retains the unilateral right to carry out genocide. And the court correctly agreed with the U.S. argument, and the U.S. was excused alone. That's happened before, also in ways that are highly relevant today. As I'm sure you know, John Negroponte was recently appointed as the first director of intelligence. And like Bolton, he too has credentials. In the 1980s, during the first reign of the current incumbents in Washington, at that time he was the ambassador to Honduras, where he presided over the world's largest CIA station. That was not because of Honduras is so significant in world affairs, but it was because he was supervising the camps in which the U.S. terror army was trained and armed for its war against Nicaragua, which was no small matter. The country was virtually destroyed. Well, if Nicaragua had adopted our norms, what it would have done is respond by terror attacks within the United States in self-defense, in this case, authentic self-defense. But it didn't. Instead, Nicaragua pursued the peaceful means that are required by international law. It brought the U.S. attack to the World Court. Nicaragua's case was presented by a distinguished Harvard University lawyer, Professor Abe Chase. The court bent over backwards to accommodate Washington. It eliminated a large part of the case that Chase presented for an interesting reason. The reason was that when the United States had accepted World Court jurisdiction in 1946, it entered a reservation, excluding the United States from any multilateral treaties, notably the UN Charter, which bans the unauthorized use of force as criminal, in fact, the supreme international crime, in the words of the Nuremberg Tribunal, but of course only when others do it. The court, therefore, restricted itself to bilateral U.S.-Nicaragua treaties and customary international law, but even on those very narrow grounds, it charged Washington with, technical words, were unlawful use of force, which in lay terms just means international terrorism, ordered Washington to terminate the crimes and pay substantial reparations, which would go far beyond overcoming the debts that are strangling the country that were accrued during the U.S. terror war. The Security Council of the United Nations affirmed the World Court judgment in two resolutions, vetoed by the United States, hence basically unreported and unknown. The U.S. immediately escalated the attack, leaving the country utterly wrecked, with a death toll that in per capita equivalent terms for us would be 2.5 million dead in the United States. That's more than all U.S. deaths in all wars in its history, including Civil War. Nicaragua has so declined that 60% of children under two are suffering from severe malnutrition, probable permanent brain damage. All of this is so deep in the memory hole in the elite intellectual culture that it's scarcely known. If you want to see some examples, take the editorials in the Boston Globe in the last few days, which are puzzling about anti-American attitudes in Nicaragua after its failed revolution, failed for some unknown reason. There are several relevant conclusions from all of this. One is it's another illustration of Washington's self-exemption from international law, including humanitarian law, based on universal principles of human rights. This case, as many others, with very grim human consequences. And it also reveals, again, the self-exemption of the elite intellectual culture from responsibility for our crimes. It's a conclusion reinforced by the fact that Washington has just appointed a leading condemned international terrorist to the position of world's leading anti-terrorist czar. All of this is quite normal. Orwell wouldn't have known whether to laugh or weep. In fact, the U.S. has refused to ratify most of the enabling conventions that were passed by the General Assembly to implement the Universal Declaration, or more accurately, it's accepted none of them, to my knowledge, because the few cases that have been ratified are accompanied by reservations that exclude the United States, just like the Genocide Convention and others. That, incidentally, includes the anti-torture conventions that have stirred up a lot of recent debate. There's an important article in the matter of the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences by a distinguished constitutional law specialist, Sanford Levinson. He joined most others in condemning the Bush Justice Department, including the recently appointed Attorney General, for having articulated, I'm quoting Levinson, for having articulated a view of presidential authority that is all too close to the power that Schmidt was willing to accord his own Führer. He's referring to Carl Schmitt, who was the leading philosopher of law during the Nazi period, and whom Levinson describes as the true eminence grise of the Bush administration. Nevertheless, Levinson offers some defense of the Justice Department authorization of torture. He points out that when the Senate ratified the UN Convention against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, and Degrading Treatment and Punishment, quoting Levinson, it offered one what one might call a more interrogator-friendly definition of torture than that adopted by the UN negotiators. And the unilateral U.S. definition does go some way towards permitting the practices that have recently enraged the world and elicited much highly critical commentary here. Well, it's depressingly easy to continue, but I'll end with one last observation about the current scene. A few days ago, I gave a talk at the Hope Church in downtown Boston. It was a meeting called by CRISPAS to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the assassination of Archbishop Romero of El Salvador, a voice for the voiceless, as he was called, murdered by security forces backed by the United States, many of them graduates of the famous School for the Americas. Romero was assassinated while he was performing mass, shortly after having sent President Carter an eloquent letter pleading with him not to send aid to the brutal military junta in El Salvador, which will sharpen the repression that has been unleashed against the people's organizations fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights. Well, that was ignored. State terror increased after the assassination, always with U.S. support. The hideous decade, not just there, ended with the murder of six leading Latin American intellectuals, Jesuit priests, by an elite U.S. armed and trained battalion that had already compiled a shocking record of atrocities, mostly the usual victims, peasants, working people, priests and lay workers, in fact, anyone connected even loosely to the people's organizations fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights. Crispus was one of the first of the mostly church-based organizations that were formed after the Romero assassination to support those who are fighting to defend their most fundamental human rights. And they did it in ways that are really of historical significance. They broke entirely new paths in many centuries of Western violence. They did it by going to live with the victims, to help them, to in the hope that a white face might protect them from the wrath of the U.S.-backed state terrorist forces. That's never happened before. I had the privilege that night, a couple days ago, of sharing the platform with Mirna Perla. She's a Salvadoran Supreme Court justice who's the widow of Herbert Anaya and is attempting to continue his work under terrible conditions. Anaya was the leading human rights activist in El Salvador. He was imprisoned and tortured by the U.S.-imposed government and then assassinated by the same hands that murdered the archbishop and the leading Jesuit intellectuals, along with tens of thousands of the usual victims and comparable stories in the neighboring countries and elsewhere. Well, in a society that valued its freedom, it would be completely unnecessary to recount any of this because it would be taught in schools and it would be well known to everyone. And we would now be preparing to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the assassination of the Voice for the Voiceless, just as we would have commemorated a few months ago the 15th anniversary of the assassination of six leading intellectuals. If anything like that, remotely like that, had happened in Eastern Europe in those years, we would certainly know about it. And in fact, we would be reacting the same way right now to the continuing atrocities by the military forces armed and trained by Washington. For example, in Colombia, which has been the leading human rights violator in the hemisphere for many years, and throughout all that period has been the leading recipient of U.S. military aid and training. It happens to be a very well-established correlation, not insignificant. Again, it would be well known to everyone in a free society or a society that valued its freedom. Last year, Colombia apparently maintained its record of killing more labor activists than the rest of the world combined. A few weeks ago, the military broke into the most important of the towns that had declared themselves zones of peace, separating themselves from the conflict, they hoped. Military murdered one of its founders and others, including his children and others, down to the age of two. I happen to have met the murdered leader on a recent visit to Colombia. The meeting was arranged by Father Javier Giraldo, who heads the church-based Justice and Peace Center. He himself has been targeted for assassination, and he was withdrawn from the country under threat by the Jesuit order, although he insisted on returning to his work supporting those who are struggling to defend their fundamental human rights. All of this should be too familiar even to mention, but fact is that little is known about it, apart from circles of people like Crispas, who are devoted to defending universal human rights. I mention these very few examples to remind ourselves that we're not engaged in seminars on abstract principles or discussing remote cultures that we do not comprehend. We're speaking of ourselves, the moral and intellectual values of the communities in which we live, and if we do not like what we see, if we look into the mirror honestly, we have ample opportunity to do something about it.
Thank you very much. I'm actually a philosophy person, writing on human rights, and you've both confirmed and sort of problematized some things that I've been sort of curious about. One, we talked, Professor Chomsky, your talk, you direct us to make this sort of anti-behavioral move in linguistics, and I think you sort of hint at how we might do so in the political realm, pointing to examples and the sort of influences that lead to different judgments. And we also point to sort of the similarities we have, you know, genetically you know, with the studies looking at little babies and stuff, and perhaps what you would call the combinatorial capacity philosophy we might call practical reason, or something like that, as sort of the basis of our difference and potentially our ability to overcome those differences. But here's another question. In a group of adults, all raised in the same country, mostly exposed to the same influences growing up, in terms of cultural influences, why is such a divergent set of moral appraisals between government elites and people not in government? What's the contribution of that particular institution to this sort of that sort of is able to overcome what would normally you would think would be very deep-seated moral intuitions?
Me or you?
Well, first of all, I don't think we have to look very far. It's true of all of us.
I mean, the examples I was giving, I purposely gave to because they illustrate the educated culture in which we are all part, which is not very far from government elites, or in fact, they're right from here, you know, and many of them people we know or the media. It's all this very. It's an intellectual, moral culture that we're all part of, like Harvard Square is right at the core of it. So if we think about it, we can answer the question by looking in the mirror. And I think the answer we find is that when you begin to play an institutional role of some kind, you can only do it. There's only two approaches you can take. One is to just recognize that the institution is inherently immoral and has to be significantly changed, in which case you're out, or else you somehow stay within it, accommodate to it, begin to internalize its values, no matter how they conflict with your own, and you live these joint lives. It's true in I think it's hard to find a counterexample. We can find it in our own lives. We find it in governments. We find it in corporations. Anywhere we look, you have these. This is your choice. Will I resist and try to change the structure of the institution if I recognize in one part of my moral capacities that it's wrong, repressive, murderous, and so on? Or will I simply accommodate to it in one fashion or another? And there are a lot of ways to do that. One of them is to convince yourself, almost always falsely, that actually you're doing good by doing wrong. That's why when you look at the history of leadership, you know, articulate leadership, you find that everything they do is noble. It's hard to find an exception. Try to find a historical exception. Even among the worst monsters, you know, Hitler, Stalin, pick your choice, everything they did was noble. And there's very good reason to think that they believed it, because we see when you look at documentary records that they talk to each other the same way they talk in public. So you kind of internalize it. So, yeah, it's moral. So when Japanese fascists, let's say, were... And there we happen to have extensive records because it's a defeated country, so therefore you get their archives. I wrote an article about it 40 years ago, if you're interested, when the records came out. But the Japanese fascists who were carrying out the most horrendous atrocities in Manchuria and North China were convinced and talked to each other privately about how they were carrying out a noble endeavor, trying to create an earthly paradise for the people of the region, led by Japan's generous and humane concern, and they had to protect them from the Chinese bandits who were trying to destroy the legitimate governments, and it was so hard, and they were suffering so much and trying to do all these wonderful things and so on. You just compare that with the actions, and what you find is that they're very much like us, because we do exactly the same thing, for example, in the cases that I mentioned. And I think the mechanisms are probably about the same. And I think if we think about it, we see them in our own lives.
Hello, I'm Hugh School up the street. that I kind of got challenged with and I challenged this table with. I'm very quick to point the finger at the U.S. military and the U.S. media, and one woman who is my age and lived through the war just looked at me and she's like, you could have taught us whatever you wanted to teach us, but we pointed at each other and killed each other. And so what challenged me was, what is it that shifts perception of humanity to non-humanity? How do people completely dehumanize each other when they're neighbors? And how do we separate this pointing fingers from what is human nature and whether it is human nature, and then how to move forward within that paradox?
But I would only say one word, and then I'll suggest that you talk about it, and that is that I don't think it makes a lot of sense to point fingers unless we're pointing them to ourselves. That's where we should start, at least. It's very easy to criticize other people for all the terrible things they do, but anyone who's honest will begin by saying, well, what am I doing? And if we look, it turns out it's not so pretty. So just to take one totally different example, everyone is very much exercised about the horrendous atrocities in Rwanda, right? For 100 days, they were killing about 8,000 people a day, roughly, you know, maybe 800,000 people, and we didn't do anything about it, and isn't that awful? Well, in fact, there's a lot more to the story. I mean, I myself was writing about those atrocities in the 1970s because they were going on. You know, not at the scale of 1994, but very serious. Something could have been done about it, and something was done about it. One of the things that was done was that the international institutions, World Bank, IMF, and others, imposed structural adjustment programs, which in fact exacerbated the conflicts, just as they had originally been almost created by Belgian and German imperialism, and then they were exacerbated by the social and economic policies that were imposed, and they finally blew up to some horrendous scale. Well, you know, the problem of using military force in Rwanda, or anywhere, in fact, is very tricky. Military force has unpredictable consequences. I mean, you really have to have strong reason to do it, the big, heavy burden of proof to bear. But there are many things very much like it that are easy to do and that we don't do, although we know about them. Like, for example, right now, there is Rwanda-level killing going on among just children in southern Africa every day. About 8,000 are dying from easily treatable diseases, which is something which we could deal with, not by military intervention, but just by a few cents. You know, in rich countries, it wouldn't even notice it. But we prefer not to look at that because there would be a marginal inconvenience. So we therefore go see Hotel Rwanda and talk about how awful they are. Well, yeah, they were pretty awful, but we don't have to look very far to find similar things.
Hey, Professor Chomsky. My question to you, it's a question that I find myself faced with people who particularly have a military background or are very patriotic to our country and our cause. It's that when having dialogue and trying to talk about things that you readily talk about or just the facts like, all around the world and things like that, people will say, well, if the corporations in our country don't have power and the money's not concentrated in our country and we don't have the strongest military power and we don't do what we're doing, someone else is going to get the power, and then are they going to be any better than we are? And then they're going to use their power to then exploit people, you know, violate human rights and so forth, and that, well, as bad as the United States is, they settle in a way and say that, okay, well, at least we're not too bad. Look at other people who are killing. We're not killing our own people and this and that. Maybe they would. And I responding to those people, I find it's like, well, I don't know what would happen if they had the power. I mean, other places have had the power, and they have exploited that power and hurt a lot of people. So trying to accurately, how would you respond to that question? Like, what would you do if we didn't have the power? And the fact that as we go to become more and more egalitarian, like if the people of our country actually exercise democracy educated, like we're educated and they exercise democracy. And the world in the next, say, 10 to 15 years started to move towards more social equality. How would we couple that and protect ourselves, essentially is the question, from a power, a dictator, or any force that could violate human rights on a mass scale? Mm-hmm. How do those two, how can they fit well together?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, the initial assumptions are, I don't think most people would accept, that we have to keep on torturing and killing people, because if we don't, they might torture and kill somebody. Well, you know, I mean, Hitler could have given that argument. So we don't want that one. But I think the basic question you ask is a good one. How can we, if we were to withdraw our own beating people over the heads with clubs, would it necessarily follow that somebody else would take that role, or are there other alternatives? Well, yeah, there are other alternatives. For example, the alternatives that are favored by the overwhelming majority of the population in the United States. I mentioned one piece of it. Let the UN function. The UN isn't perfect. There's a lot of things wrong with it. Just like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights isn't perfect. A lot of things wrong with it. But one step would be to let, to pay some respect to the decent opinion of mankind, to quote the famous author, and let international institutions function so as to reduce the likelihood that anybody will use force. After all, remember the UN Charter in 1945, which unfortunately most people don't know, just like they don't know the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, it was formed. It starts off by saying that the goal is to save the human species from the curse of war, which twice in their generation had led to vast destruction, and which, as everyone knew in 1945, was, if it went on, was going to kill everybody, because this was right after the atom bombs. It's interesting that everyone knew that, but nobody could say it because of U.S. power. So if you look at the charter, long charter, there's a lot about the curse of war, but the words nuclear or any one like them don't appear. But that was what was on everyone's mind. We're at the point where we have now developed a technology that can destroy the world. Okay, so therefore we have to save ourselves from the curse of war, and institutions were constructed to try to overcome just what you're pointing to. The core principles of the UN Charter are that the use of force is illegal. It's criminal. It's the supreme international crime from which all other crimes follow, unless it is used under extremely narrow conditions. One condition is authorization of the Security Council. Okay, you can ask whether that's the right way to do it or not, but it's at least some step towards the right way to do it. The only other condition was if a country is under attack, then you can use force in self-defense. Now, let's come back to ourselves today. In the United States, the elite intellectual culture, the one we're part of, flatly rejects that, and says that the United States and alone, maybe we can delegate it to our clients, but essentially the United States alone has the right of what's called anticipatory self-defense, meaning we attack anyone we want because we claim that maybe they'll be a threat to us someday. That's flatly in violation of the Charter. It's the bipartisan consensus. It's the media consensus. It's the elite intellectual consensus, not 100%, but overwhelmingly. And then people just argue about, well, you know, is this or that the right place to do it? But and of course, nobody else is allowed to have that right. I mean, that's outlandish, you know, like that Nicaragua, say, would have had the right to carry out terror in the United States in legitimate self-defense is unthinkable. But we have that right just for ourselves. We can delegate it to clients. But I'll say the same thing I said before. The overwhelming majority of the population rejects that. You take a look at the unpublished, almost always unpublished, major studies of public opinion. These, in fact, were released right before the election, when they were crucially important for a democratic society, but suppressed, show that a large majority of the public accepts the basic principles of the UN Charter against the use of force. And if we're in a better position to implement those principles than anyone else, because we're way more powerful than anyone else, so if we join the rest of the world in trying to implement those principles, then there's hope that no other power will take the place that the powerful states now have, us in particular. And there are many examples of this. I'll just take one another example from last November, which also didn't get reported, and we should ask why. And there is a fissile material cutoff treaty. It's a international treaty that tries to prevent the there are technically, you know, the treaties blocking it, but this one would put some enforcement procedures into preventing the development of materials for nuclear weapons. Okay, you read on the front pages of the New York Times this morning, lead story, the U.S. wants to prevent its enemies, like Iran, from even getting the rights they now have with regard to making these materials. But there is on the agenda, a much broader one, which tries to prevent, to cut off the production of material which can be used for nuclear weapons, which are very likely to destroy us all. Well, it's been negotiated for years internationally. It came to a vote at the general, what amounts to the General Assembly, Disarmament Commission of the General Assembly. It's the whole General Assembly. It came to a vote last November, and the vote was 147-1 with two abstentions. 147-1 is very typical of international votes, not this administration, going way back, or maybe, you know, 150-2 or something like that, because the U.S. does insist upon rights that it denies to everyone else, like the right to use force, the right to commit genocide, and so on and so forth. In this case, the United States voted against, it was the only country to vote against the measures to enforce the restriction on production of weapons, of material for nuclear weapons, which is likely to destroy us all. Well, what about the two states that abstained? One of them abstains reflexively. Israel has to abstain because it's relying on the United States for whatever it's doing. So that's reflexive. The other one is a second client state, Britain. And Britain abstained, which it usually does, in fact, abstained on the Security Council resolutions on Nicaragua too and many others. And in fact, the British representative, if you look at the General Assembly proceedings, explained why he had to abstain. He said, we're very much in favor of this treaty, and, you know, we're going to work really hard to get enforcement procedures and so on. But the particular proposal that was voted on, he said, is divisive, which is true. It divided the world 147-1. So, therefore, he had to abstain. Well, you know, these things are under our control. We could change all those policies, and the overwhelming majority of the population doesn't want to change. But in order to change them, we have to do something about it. And that's in direct reaction to your question. We do not want, nobody sane wants any country to be developing the kinds of weaponry which will destroy all of us. And one way to prevent that is by putting enforcement mechanisms into the vague treaties that bar it. But the U.S. won't allow that, and it is allowed to get away with it because nobody in the country knows it. I bet if you do a poll at, you know, say, Harvard Faculty Club or wherever educated people are, unless it's somebody who's involved in, you know, disarmament programs, nobody will have ever heard of this. And it's like a death sentence, and it happens all the time. You know.